Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
The fallout from the Harvey Weinstein scandal is spreading, with other men in Hollywood and in media also facing accusations and losing their jobs. Actor Dustin Hoffman has been accused of sexually harassing an intern on a film set in 1985. Filmmaker Tony Montana says he was groped at a bar by actor Kevin Spacey in 2003. And the former senior vice president of news for NPR, Michael Oreskes, resigned yesterday after allegations against him. Across the Atlantic, the UK has a new defense secretary after Sir Michael Fallon resigned over sexual harassment allegations. Now, there are laws in place to protect against sexual harassment and abuse, but how does the legal process work in these cases, and is it fair? Deborah Rohde is a professor of law at Stanford University. She's an expert in gender discrimination law. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
And first of all, what is the legal definition of sexual harassment?
Well, there are two forms of sexual harassment. One is what's called quid pro quo harassment, which is exchanging favors for some job opportunity. The other is a hostile environment form of harassment, which is creating a pervasive atmosphere that interferes with work performance.
Is it hard to prove that?
Sex harassment cases have historically been difficult to prove. Oftentimes, there are no witnesses, and the conduct is sometimes seen as trivial. And sometimes a single incident is, but when you have a cumulative pattern, it really creates a corrosive workplace. And sex harassment, despite a quarter century of laws and litigation, still is a very high cause of loss of jobs, job turnover, lack of retention, and social and psychological difficulties resulting from the experience of being in one of those workplaces.
Does it make a difference if the harassment occurs at the office or somewhere else?
Well, if it occurs at the office and the individual has no easy exit alternative, that puts their livelihoods at risk in a way that sex harassment in other contexts doesn't. But certainly sex harassment, for example, in universities can be equally detrimental to jobs and careers and emotional and psychological well-being.
What do you make of all of the allegations that have come out ever since the Harvey Weinstein allegations? Because it does seem like there's a big difference between some of the things that he's accused of and some of the things that other people are being accused of.
Well, sure, it's on a spectrum, and not all of the claims that we're seeing surfacing now look like ones that would probably constitute a hostile environment. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, for centuries, women, especially women, but also men to some extent, have been harassed but had neither a title or a remedy for it. That's finally started to change, and it's changing because I think the culture is finally waking up to the pervasiveness of the problem and the recognition that power and entitlement breeds a form of abuse that can lead, if unchecked, to serial offenders, the Roger Ailes, the Bill O'Reillys, the Harvey Weinsteins. And, you know, it used to be that women rarely were willing to go public with this. And I think we're now seeing a sea change in that view.
Are there risks, though, that with this tsunami of allegations that some people are getting caught up in this, that in some cases the allegations are anonymous, but the accused is not anonymous in the public eye and ends up losing a job right away?
Yeah. Well, you worry a lot about what the effects of unsubstantiated allegations are against public figures. And that's a real downside of what we're seeing, because there's no easy way, oftentimes, with claims that are decades old, for people to assemble proof if, in fact, they haven't engaged in the conduct. And, of course, celebrities have deep pockets and a lot to lose. So the possibility for extortion and exploitation of them is there. But, you know, there's, I think, some natural deterrence to prevent the kind of conduct, because there's always a backlash against people who are seen to be gold diggers and just trumping up some fabricated allegations.
You mentioned Bill O'Reilly from Fox News, who paid $32 million to a colleague at Fox News who's threatened to sue him for alleged sexual misconduct. That was in addition to other settlements that he had paid. How did these settlements come about as a remedy for this?
I think the Bill O'Reilly settlement happened because the complainant in that case, who's someone I know actually, is an extremely good lawyer, probably had collected good documentary evidence and had perfect timing. She waited for a moment when his contract was up for renewal and he was in the midst of a custody battle and had a lot to lose if the allegations went public. So she had enormous leverage in that bargaining. But that's not true of victims in general. And I think one worry about the celebrity cases is that people underestimate how difficult it normally is for victims to win these suits and what the social costs will be from bringing them.
Is there any kind of statute of limitations for accusations? Because many of the accusations we've been hearing about, as you've mentioned, come from decades ago.
There certainly are in courts of law, but in the world of public opinion, not so much. So you can see people losing their jobs for conduct that occurred well before the statute of limitations. They may not have a legal claim, but they have an audience, and the reputational injuries, as we've seen with someone like Kevin Spacey, can be substantial.
How many of these cases do you think are going to end up going to court, and how many are just going to be settled in the court of public opinion?
Rarely are sex harassment cases actually litigated. We know that historically less than 5% of cases get to court, fewer than those are actually litigated. And what normally happens when the cases are filed is they're settled with a confidentiality clause that prevents the victim from disclosing any details. And that's one of the issues that's gotten so much attention with these recent cases, because, of course, the way that perpetrators maintained their power was through settlements that had confidentiality clauses that gagged the victims.
That's Deborah Rohde, who's a professor of law at Stanford University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.